Hello again, friends, and welcome to a special episode of Access City Hall on the Mass and City Channel. I'm your host, Stu Levitan, and this is the first in a series on urban renewal and civil rights in Madison in the 60s. The forced transformation of part of the Greenbush neighborhood into the Triangle urban renewal area was perhaps the most significant civic act in Madison in the late 20th century. But I don't think there's a project or a policy in Madison's history that better illustrates the observation from the poet T.S. Eliot that between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow. The 52-acre Triangle and adjacent 7-acre Brittingham urban renewal projects are rightly roundly criticized for their very poor planning, particularly the absolutely abysmal record in relocating the displaced Triangle residents. But what about the basic concept itself of turning those 59 acres into an urban renewal area? Can we work back from bad planning and bad execution and assume bad motive and lack of justification? A lot of people do, but I don't think that's fair or even intellectually honest. I believe the issue of justification is completely separate from the issue of execution, and that's one of the big issues we're going to focus on in this hour. We're also going to address the impact of racism on urban renewal, both institutional and individual. So here we see the eastern tip of the Greenbush neighborhood and a few blocks of Pregler's Addition. It's a 60-year-old neighborhood that was intergenerational, interracial, interreligious, but alas had inadequate infrastructure, bad land use allocation, and substandard housing. So over the next 10 years, this would be transformed into this, the Triangle and Brittingham urban renewal areas. Although, and here you see the outlines of the Triangle and the Brittingham renewal area, the Brittingham area south of West Washington Avenue, the Triangle north and a little bit west of Park Street. And the critical component to creating a urban renewal district and the reason why the city did was this, the amount of money that the city would receive from the federal government. A total project cost of just under $6 million, for which the city paid about $1.3 or $1.4 million, and got such things as brand new streets, brand new sewers, and most importantly, 59 acres cleared and ready for development. Now, the story begins with the land. This is from the plat map of 1904, and you see on the screen some of the discussion and description of the land at issue in the urban renewal area from the federal reports. Earlier in its history, the project area was part of a marsh extending 1,200 feet on either side of Regent between Randall and Murray and along Murray to Lake Monona. The marsh was traversed by a small creek, the bed of which is now occupied by a large concrete box storm sewer. This is one of the critical issues about the Triangle urban renewal area and why they provided it. It was the inadequate infrastructure. We had flooding. We had, as you see, as the marsh was filled in, streets were built only 3 to 4 feet above the original marsh. We had inadequate storm sewers, inadequate sanitation sewers, no basements, and the infrastructure was just sorely, sorely lacking. And as you'll see as we go through the justification for the urban renewal area, it turns out to be streets and sewers and structures, not people. That is one of the recurring themes in this discussion. So this is what the land looked like in 1904. And here we get to an issue of terminology. You'll see the Greenbush Addition itself goes all the way down to Erin Street and all the way west to Mill Street. That is far more than what was in the Triangle urban renewal area. The green, sort of the chartreuse outline on this map is the Triangle urban renewal area. The yellow is Pregler's Addition, and the red is the Greenbush Addition. For the sake of this conversation, we'll call the Triangle and the Bush coterminous, even though they're technically not. But when people, in talking about urban renewal, speak about the Bush, they generally refer to the area within the Triangle area that you see outlined in green. Along with the inadequate storm sewers and inadequate sanitation sewers, there were street issues. It may be a little bit difficult to see from this image, but there's a 10-foot-high peak at Mound Street. those of us who have lived in Madison any time since the late 1960s wouldn't know this, but prior to urban renewal, Park Street had a tremendous hill 10 feet high. You can see on the southern slope, you can sort of make out the difference in elevation. That's another issue why there was urban renewal. Also, the streets. You can see so much of the Greenbush neighborhood was filled with streets. And these were streets that were opened in the 1880s and were last improved in the 1920s. So they were built for horse and carriage. They were built for Model Ts. They had high crown streets, high curbs. They were totally inadequate and inappropriate for the modern day automobile. 45% of the neighborhood was filled with streets. That is not adequate or proper land use. And you can see down in the bottom corner, that little triangle, that is a completely inadequate allocation of space. And that's another thing that the planners would focus on, was the inadequate land use planning and the inappropriate uses within a block. And this one block, let me go back a second, you'll see in the lower right-hand corner, there's a little triangular block. We're going to focus on that right now. And you'll see three starred buildings or three starred areas in this block. This is the 700 block of West Washington Avenue. The cross streets are Murray to the left and Mound right above it. So you see these three starred areas. Here's the first of those three buildings that starred, Neighborhood House. One of the most important, perhaps the most important, secular building in Madison through the 20th century. This was a settlement house that served the people of the Greenbush neighborhood, the Italians, Albanians, Sicilians, the Jews, the African Americans. This was the neighborhood glue. This was the most important secular structure, certainly in the neighborhood, quite possibly in the city as well. You'll see next door there's a bar and grill. I don't think it's necessarily modern land use planning to put a bar and grill next to a neighborhood house that's going to be utilized by children. What's one of the other buildings? So you see that the neighborhood house is the building in the lower right, the white building with a star on it. This is the other building. Here you see the star building in the center top, Adas Yesharun Synagogue, opened in 1939 to serve the Orthodox members of the Jewish faith in the neighborhood. Now, some of the Jews had already started to move out from the neighborhood. Agudas Chaim Synagogue had already closed, but this was Adas Yesharun. This would stay vibrant until it was forced to close during urban renewal. So we see one building is a neighborhood house, and one building is a temple. And what is that third structure in the lower right-hand corner? It's a junkyard. It's Gerke's junkyard. Now, when it comes to incompatible land uses, there may be a bigger problem than locating a junkyard on the same block as the neighborhood house and a house of worship, but for the life of me, I cannot think of what it is. And the incompatible uses throughout the neighborhood is, again, one of the major reasons why the planners proposed an urban renewal district. We've got meatpacking plants, we've got bar and grill, we've got junkyards, we've got every lot fronting on West Washington, Park Street, or Regent Street is zoned commercial. There's not a single block in this entire neighborhood that is entirely zoned for residential. And although new urbanism of today would speak highly of locating various shops and for goods and services within walking distance, to walk past a junkyard on the way to your house, to walk past a meatpacking plant on the way to your house, to not be able to get to your residence without going through a commercial area, including junkyards and meatpacking plants, is not proper land use planning. And this is another justification for the planners proposing an urban renewal district, is to deal with the incompatible uses. Here we see that even though the frontage area on the highways is entirely zoned commercial, not all the uses are commercial. And here we get to the issue of non-conforming uses. Residential properties on commercial lots on residential properties. And in the right-hand corner, you see the number of deficiencies that were noted on each block. And this is another issue where the planners would use statistics to justify the urban renewal district. It's not just in improper land use allocation, it's substandard housing within the residential district, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. I mentioned streets, and this is another critical component to the urban renewal district, was the expansion of Park Street and West Washington Avenue. Here we see West Washington Avenue as a pretty narrow street. It would be expanded to 132 feet, as would Park Street. And here we see the 700 block of West Washington Avenue showing the impact of those incompatible uses on a residential neighborhood and the impact of substandard structures on that neighborhood. We're just going to take a brief walk up the 700 block of West Washington Avenue, again, to give you a sense of what the quality of the buildings was like in the Triangle at the time of urban renewal. So we're going to start at the corner of Mound and West Washington and just walk down the street. So here's the corner of Mound and West Washington. The abbreviations along with the addresses where it says S or Y or SS or N, S means the house, the structure is standard. It is sufficient. It has all the modern amenities. SS means it is substandard. It lacks indoor toilets or it lacks a central heating plant. Y means that it is economically feasible to maintain or bring up to current code. No means it is economically not feasible to bring up to code or to bring up to code. And this is, these are the criteria that would justify the approval of the Federal Urban Renewal District. The city had to justify and document that a majority of the structures in the area were either substandard or economically not feasible to bring up to code. That's why these S and Y abbreviations are so important. So here we see the 700 block of West Washington just walking down the street from the corner of Mound Street. And you'll get a sense of what the structures are like and what the frontage that the neighborhood was showing to the rest of the world. So we just walk. Here's Troyes Market. It is both quality in the current standard and is economically feasible to bring up to further standards. But next door, literally next door, is a structure that should be torn down. Again, two doors down, a house that is standard but cannot be maintained, economically feasible. Next to that, two more residences that should be torn down. Three more residences that are substandard even under the current conditions and cannot economically be made whole to come up to code. Again, further down the block, we see an empty lot and finally a restaurant that is both standard and can be maintained. So you see that all those structures on West Washington explain, again, why the planners looked at this neighborhood and saw a property that was ripe for urban renewal. Here are the standards for what decent, safe, and sanitary housing requires. Two separate exits, a central heating plant, no substantial sagging of floors, adequate and safe electrical wiring, connection to public sewage disposal, lavatory and bathtub or shower, an indoor flush toilet for the exclusive use of the household, and so on. So if you see a property that is labeled as substandard or SS in this presentation, it means that it fails one of these basic criteria. It doesn't have flush toilets for the exclusive use of the family. It doesn't have a central heating plant. It is housing that should be torn down. And I have gone through every one of the building inspection reports in the Historical Society archives, and they document, here's an example of how they document the quality of housing along the street. We're just going to go down a couple of houses on Mound Street and Mill Street. So here we see a house. It's owner-occupied for 22 years, quite neat, but sagged. Everything slopes, but yet they found that it was standard housing and could be maintained economically to at an economically feasible standard. In the bottom, you see in red, the number at the left is the assessment, the most current assessment. The number at the right is the price which the redevelopment authority paid. And essentially what the redevelopment authority did was get two appraisals, would pay the greater of the two appraisals, subject to approval by the federal government. And this is another problem that the city had in dealing with the local community, which was really not entirely its fault. Every price that the city paid had to be approved by the federal government. And I saw examples where the Madison Redevelopment Authority would propose paying a price, and the feds would knock it down by $750. And people in Madison would feel outraged. They only gave me $5,000, they only gave me $8,000 for my property, but that was not entirely within the local redevelopment authority's authority, because they were subject to the federal government. So here we see 717 quality housing, literally across the street, a housing that should be torn down because it doesn't even have central heating system, just two coal stoves. Again, next door, another substandard house that should be torn down. But we see the price that the city is paying is roughly, at this time in 1961-62, a brand new ranch house in Orchard Ridge would retail for $25,000. The city paid $10,000 for this. Milton Street, 713 substandard, 715 substandard. Even though the owners have made an effort to improve, 717 substandard. So here we see three houses all in a row that should be torn down. Here's an example of how the city agents actually documented the quality of the housing. These are the structure surveys for 822 West Washington, 814 Mound Street, 810 and a half Mound Street. And the way they determined whether or not it was economically feasible to bring the property up to code was they figured out what the most recent assessment was. They figured out how much could reasonably be spent to improve the property. They took as inventory of what would have to be done to fix the property, and if it would cost more to fix it than could be spent, that meant it was economically not feasible. And this is the documentation, and this is what that results in. This results in 50% of the house of the structures in the Triangle Urban Renewal Area being either substandard or economically not feasible to be brought up to code. That was the magic number that the city had to hit in order to get approval for the Federal Urban Renewal District. You see at the top that there's a very balanced breakout between the racial composition of the occupants of standard and substandard housing. Whites accounted for about 70% of the population, non-whites for 30%, and that breaks out pretty equally through the substandard and the standard housing. You'll note that I've spoken almost exclusively now about just the structures, the streets, the sewers. These are the things that the urban planners focused on in justifying their report. They did not look at the community. They did not look at the intergenerational, interracial, interreligious community. And to a certain extent, what I've done here so far today is focus on, as I say, the streets, the sewers, the structures, and not the people. Here are some of the people in the Triangle Urban Renewal Area. That is where we're going to pick it up when we come back. It is a special episode of Access City Hall on the Madison City Channel, Urban Renewal and Civil Rights in the 60s. We take a short pause for the cause. Please stay with us.
We need to go meet the guys. I'm lit. Can you drive?
Pool party at Jesse's.
Can you drive?
Will you drive? I'm a little toasty.
Nope.
Nope.
Nope, I'm high. But I can order us a ride.
Okay.
Friendly reminder, don't drive high. If you feel different, you drive different.
Welcome back to a special episode of Access City Hall on the Mass and City Channel. I'm still Stu, you're still you. We are still talking about urban renewal and civil rights in Madison in the 60s. And in that first segment, I talked exclusively about streets and sewers and structures, because those are the things that the planners looked at. They were totally oblivious to the fact that this was an intergenerational community of many cultures, many races, many ethnicities, many heritages. Some people today think that the city and the redevelopment authority went in intentionally to destroy the neighborhood. I think they were oblivious to the neighborhood. They looked exclusively at infrastructure. They did not see community. So let's take a look at this slide and see, just in this one picture, we can see how many different nationalities, Italians, Sicilians, Albanians, African Americans, German Jews, Russian Jews. This was the great melting pot of Madison. And urban renewal affected the three groups differently. The adult and elderly Italians suffered the greatest social and cultural disruption because they had the most to lose. They had been there the longest. They had the closest intergenerational households and the most extended social networks. And critical aspects of their personal lives were tied to specific places. And when those places were gone, aspects of their lives would be gone as well. Some would return to live in the buildings on their old land, but it would not be the same. Now, whether the children and the teens who are relocated, and this photo is from about 1960, so flash forward to what a group of neighborhood house children from 1960 would look like, and the question of whether or not they would have stayed in the old Greenbush if they had not been relocated for urban renewal, I think is a very open question, but certainly the impact on the adults and especially the elderly was profound, and you'll see in a moment the demographics. Actually, here are the demographics of the triangle. 65 persons over age 70, 130 persons over age 60 who were relocated. Urban renewal was terribly disruptive to their lives. The 370 people who were under 21, less so. The 35 university students, not much. Certainly the 64 households on welfare were impacted, as were the 57 households on Social Security. We're going to talk in a moment about race, and you'll see an interesting aspect regarding that. Air Force households, there were 16 households living in the triangle who had a man stationed at Truax Air Force Base. Of those 16 families, 15 were non-white. And this bottom line is a very telling statistic. Citywide, 3.3% of the households had more than a person and a half per room. In the triangle, that number was 6%. So the housing in the triangle was almost twice as crowded within each room as the housing elsewhere in the city. Now, the impact on the Jewish community was less disruptive than on the Italian community because they had already started migrating west. There were still some members of the founding families, the Sinaikos and the Sweets and so on, but the original conservative synagogue, Agudas Achim, had already closed in 1949, and its Torah were taken to the Beth Israel Center, which was still on Mound Street, but it's four blocks west in the Vilas neighborhood, not in the Greenbush neighborhood anymore. And that's a very telling demarcation when the Orthodox synagogue moves into the Vilas neighborhood, and some of the clientele for the kosher meat markets start leaving the neighborhood. That's a tipping point. Now, there are many instances in which urban renewal is sardonically and bitterly referred to as Negro removal. I don't think that's the true motivation here, but there is no doubt that non-whites were put at a distinct disadvantage because this was still the era of legal housing discrimination on the basis of race. And you see here the racial composition of the triangle. 311 households, 204 white, 97 non-white. Population, 1155, 786 white, 369 non-white. The numbers stay pretty steady, But there's a great diversion when we get to home ownership and tenancy. 63% of white households are tenants, 87% of non-white households are tenants. 37% of white households are owners of their property, only 13% of non-whites are owners. That is a very telling statistic. The income is also very revealing, and you'll note that blacks are more well off than whites. There are more poor whites. 10% of the white households are living in poverty at under $200 a month, whereas only 1% of the non-white households are. 73% of the non-white households have a monthly income of over $350. Only 56% of the white households do. The reason for that is because in the age of racial discrimination, when there is no legal barrier to imposing racial covenants or just deciding not to rent to someone because you don't like their color, blacks were segregated in only a few neighborhoods in Madison, the so-called traditional neighborhoods. The Triangle is in Ward 9. That is the heaviest population of non-whites, 80 black residents. Ward 14, south the Park Street area, is second with 72. The campus area has 11. Downtown has another 15. There are, so out of the 1,489 African Americans living in Madison, 76% live in just those first four wards. There are eight aldermanic wards that are lily white, either due to institutional or individual racism. This is what non-whites are up against when it comes to relocating from the bush. And one of the tragedies is that when they figured that they had to leave the bush because it was being undergoing urban renewal, they moved to South Madison, which was next in line to have urban renewal. And you'll see the city or the redevelopment authority made the representation to the federal government in 1960. No special relocation problems are anticipated relating to the relocation of minority families, large families, the handicapped, or the aged. Well, that just wasn't true. And by the following February, you can see people are publicly saying that urban renewal is working a hardship on the African Americans in Madison. The executive director of the Redevelopment Authority went to the Board of Realtors and pleaded with them to stop imposing barriers on home ownership for African Americans. And the president of the Board of Realtors, this is the president of the Madison Board of Realtors in 1961, said publicly, quote, "No matter what our moral convictions are, when a colored person purchases a house next door, it's going to have economic ramifications." This is why the official federal reports for people being relocated from an urban renewal project, total number of housing units available to non-whites. Housing discrimination in the United States before the Civil Rights Acts and before local and state open housing laws was so routine that the federal government pre-printed forms so you could allocate total housing and the housing available to non-whites. You see at the bottom there are 18,774 housing units that they expected to be placed on the market. 4,400 were available to non-whites. That's 19% of the total housing units are available to non-whites. And again, there's an economic distribution here where if a black person is looking for the cheap housing, under $40 a month or under $5,000 for sale, they have the same access to pretty much as a white person. But when they get to the more expensive housing, even though the African Americans living in the bush had more economic clout than the white households living in the bush, they were not able to use that economic clout and purchase or rent properties because as the properties got more expensive, the racial discrimination became more evident. So one of the outstanding criticisms and very valid criticisms against the Redevelopment Authority at the time is its representation to the federal government that adequate housing for non-whites was available Roger Rupnow would soon find out, and the city of Madison would soon find out, that was not the case. This is a photo from about 1957, and you can get a sense of the land uses in the triangle. This is the street running diagonal from the bottom of the screen to the upper right corner is Park Street. You can kind of see Regent Street arcing around to the left and the Brittingham Park by the waterfront. You can get a sense of, on one hand, the vibrancy, on the other hand, the lack of a coherent land use plan within the triangle. Here we can see a meatpacking plant next to a residence. We can see bar and grill next to a neighborhood house. We can see junkyards. We can see extensive fruit orchards and backyard gardens, which are a wonderful thing, but six blocks from the Capitol, a land use planner might say that is not an adequate use of valuable urban real estate to have a tomato garden when we've got land that could be used in that way closer to the water, as has been done in more recent years. One of the criticisms of the city and the Redevelopment Authority is that it said it would follow one process and then did something completely different. And to a very considerable extent, that is true. But the Redevelopment Authority has a pretty good explanation for that, and that is that the laws and the way they're administered kept changing. The city received its final approval plan for the Brittingham plan in 1956 and began raising and buying property in 1957. Actually, they bought it and then they raised it. So urban renewal is underway, but then in February 1958, a Milwaukee County judge says it is illegal to use eminent domain without a jury determination on the need to acquire the property. It's called a jury verdict as to necessity. February 2, 1958, while Brittingham is already underway and the review process for the triangle is underway, the Federal Housing and Home Finance Agency stops all progress on these projects until the legal situation is worked out. The Wisconsin legislature very quickly passes a new law called the Blight Elimination and Slum Clearings Act, gives municipalities the right to acquire the property. And on June 26, 1958, the city proposes an urban renewal agency, the Madison Redevelopment Authority. You see the date. It's proposed on June 26. It is approved on July 11th. In just 2 weeks, the city of Madison creates an independent corporate body that has the power to acquire and tear down property, levy taxes, implement urban renewal projects, and they do it in just 2 weeks, which is a remarkably efficient way for local government to work. That November, a referendum to issue $1 million in bonds for the triangle is approved, 16,000 to 11,000. So it appears that everything is well on its way. But the federal government is not impressed with the way the city and the Redevelopment Authority are proceeding. Here's some correspondence I found deep in the files from the regional director to Roger Rupnow, the local Redevelopment Authority director. You will take immediate steps to restudy the project area with the thought of excluding sound structures from acquisition and demolition. This project may become one of clearance and rehabilitation instead of complete clearance. The federal government kept telling the city of Madison this was a rehab and renovation project. The city of Madison kept saying, no, no, it is a complete clearance project. This would go on for years, and it is one of the imponderables and unanswerable questions. What would have happened to Madison and this entire area if the federal government had prevailed and this had been a rehab and renovation project, not a complete demo project? And then, after the state passes the blight elimination law, another judge, local Dane County Judge Edwin Wilkie, decides that the law is unconstitutional because it gives to the Redevelopment Authority the power to acquire property, which Judge Wilkie decided was unconstitutional. That goes to the Supreme Court, and the law is struck down, but the Redevelopment Authority is preserved. And what I like about this decision is that the lawyer for the people who were being sued by the city, the people who lived in the bush, Canepa and Zach Trotter and Vitali and Licari, the lawyer representing the people in the bush was one of the most distinguished lawyers in the state of Wisconsin, Gordon Sinekin, who himself grew up in the bush at 106 South Murray Street, a property that by the time he was in front of the Supreme Court was substandard and needed to be torn down. So it is important to remember that a lot of really outstanding people and a great outstanding community came from the bush, notwithstanding the quality of the housing or the sewers or the streets. Federal government keeps telling the city that you may damn well lose this project if you don't get going. Your statistics don't make any sense. This is a rehab project. The city keeps pressing. The city keeps pressing. The fact that the Triangle area needs an organized program of renewal areas is basic. Complete reconstruction is considered to represent the only feasible method of correcting these conditions. The city says that in late 1959. And finally, the day before the final Christmas of the 1950s, the federal government says, okay, you have approval to do the Triangle. The city approves its first land use plan, and you can see it is already being changed. We've got a shopping center at the corner of Park and Regent. The allocation of streets is different from what we saw previously. Now, the city does not claim dilapidated housing as the primary reason. It cites the land use. It cites the incompatible uses. It cites the streets, the sewers, and the fact that there are a certain percentage of housing that is either substandard or inadequate or cannot be economically brought up to code. The city made the representation that not all buildings would be torn down. Quote, a number of buildings in good condition will be left undisturbed. That turned out to not be true either. After the Triangle project, attention would again turn to the Brittingham project across the street. You'll see this establishing shot from 1957. Look in the upper right-hand corner, because that is where we're going to focus on next. This is the Brittingham area. Here is a closer focus on the Brittingham area. You can see a number of bars, a number of rooming houses. This is 1957 when all the properties are still there. Here we see that establishing shot from 1960, and you'll see that most of those properties that we saw in the 1957 shot have now been eliminated. There are just a few properties left, and that is where we are going to pick it up when we come back after a short pause. It is it's a special urban renewal and civil rights episode of Access City Hall. We're going to take a short pause for some important announcements. When we come back, we're going to hear the sad saga of the travails of Zach Trotter and some more about life in Madison and urban renewal and civil rights in the 60s. It's Access City Hall on the Madison City Channel. Please stay with us.
Oh, Vanessa. You going to text her back? Nope. I'm high. I'm going to hit the treadmill.
You're already making good decisions when you're high.
We need to go meet the guys. I'm lit. Can you drive?
Nope. I'm high. How about they come over?
Where?
They'll make an exception when it comes to driving. If you feel different, you drive different.
Welcome back to a special episode of Access City Hall on the Madison City Channel. I'm Stu Levitan. We're looking at the history of urban renewal and civil rights in Madison in the 60s. Talking about whether or not it was justified on the basis of the quality of the structures, the nature of the land use, and what some of the implications were, especially when it comes time to non-whites being able to relocate in an era of housing discrimination. What we're going to do now in this segment is focus on the 1960-61 era and what's going on in Brittingham. Here we see the Brittingham project almost entirely clear. There are only three structures left, and we will talk about those in a moment. Two of the very important people in the history of urban renewal in Madison were Florence and Chester Zmudzinski. In the left, that's Florence in the early 1960s, and a photo from about the 1990s in the right. As early as the summer 1960, the Redevelopment Authority realized that it had a serious issue with people living in Brittingham and the Triangle being concerned about their looming relocation and what it would mean for their lives. So they hired a social worker, and that was Florence Medzinski. And what's interesting and a bit disturbing about this is that Chester Medzinski, in addition to being the executive director of the Madison Neighborhood Center, which means that he ran the Neighborhood House and the other two local neighborhood centers, one in South Madison, one on the east side, he was also the chair of the Local Committee for Urban Renewal, which was a federally mandated committee that had the authority to publicly comment to the Redevelopment Authority and to the federal government to assess how good a job the Redevelopment Authority was doing. So Chester Medzinski is a very powerful, very important person whom the Redevelopment Authority wants to keep in a good mood, because he has the power to comment to the federal government on what the Redevelopment Authority is doing. So Chester Medzinski suggests the Madison Neighborhood Centers will hire a social worker that the Redevelopment Authority should pay for to help the people in the Triangle. And the Redevelopment Authority says, sure. But then the federal government says that that's not an allocatable cost. They can't reimburse the Neighborhood Center for hiring a social worker. So the Redevelopment Authority hires the social worker itself, and they hire Chester's wife, Florence. And for the next 3-4 years, Florence Medzinski would be the primary relocation specialist for the Redevelopment Authority, while Chester is the chair of the independent committee that has the power to comment on whether the Redevelopment Authority is doing a good job or not. It would seem to me that is something of a conflict. Chester and Florence were considered saints at the time. They did great work on behalf of the neighborhood and behalf of their clients, but I think there was something untoward about essentially Chester pressuring the Redevelopment Authority to hire his wife. As 1961 opens, the big issue in Brittingham and the Triangle is there going to be public housing for the people who are being dislocated? And the Housing Authority is really pressing for public housing. The Redevelopment Authority, that's the MRA, doesn't want it at all. Here we have, they have a joint meeting where Chester just levels them both, says there's no coordination. You're responsible and you're not serving the people. One of the commissioners, what the devil are we going to do with the people of the Triangle while we're clearing it? By 1961, they realize they're going to start tearing people's houses down without providing a place for them to go to. And this is, the minutes say, the question was raised what would happen to the people who are losing their housing? And the minutes don't provide an answer. By February 61, it becomes clear that there are problems that are going to develop because people see the writing on the wall. They know the urban renewal is coming. They're trying to leave, and they're not finding adequate housing. So this is February 2nd. Chester levels the MRA and the MHA, saying, we need public housing, we need public housing. 2 days later, they issue the sales booklet, the sales brochure for Brittingham Park, and the way it is described, it's clear it's going to be market-rate housing. There will be no public housing at Brittingham to serve the people and the Triangle. They say that it would delay the project, that the people from Brittingham have already been relocated, and this is the first instance where it's really documented that people are crying for public housing and the Redevelopment Authority is saying no, and this decision to only go to market rate housing and not provide public housing in Brittingham will come back to haunt the Redevelopment Authority over the next several years. The other thing that haunts the Redevelopment Authority is the fact that Babe Rohr, Alderman Harold Babe Rohr, is one of its members. Babe Rohr is one of the most powerful members on the city council. He represents the 14th District, the South Park Street area, South Madison. He is the president, he is the business agent of the Painters Local. He's the president of the Building and Trades Council, which makes him a very powerful labor leader. He has a power base that no other alderman can match And he uses it for ends that are not always consistent with good public policy. And in the spring of 1961, he finds out that there's a church in his ward that is going to sell to a non-white congregation. He bursts into a board of trustees meeting and tries to get them to cancel the sale. And Babe Rohr is on Madison Redevelopment Authority. He is in charge of helping to relocate 350 non-white families. And it's pretty clear that he is not entirely sympathetic to their plight. The NAACP, Odell Taliaferro, who lives in the bush, who's definitely directly affected by this, is the president of the NAACP. They call on Rohr to quit or the mayor to fire him. It doesn't happen. We see this continued fight between the MRA and the MHA over housing. The MHA is pleading for public housing. It's saying, if we don't have public housing in Brittingham, people, because this will be built in time for people who are going to about to lose their housing in the Triangle. They're pleading for public housing in the spring, in May of 1961. The Redevelopment Authority rejects it, and the City Council absolutely rejects it. So there'll be no public housing in Brittingham. The people in the Triangle are disappointed. It is clear to them now that they will be losing their homes without adequate replacement housing. The next day, Mayor Henry Reynolds, who actually grew up in one of the areas where non-whites lived on the 600 block of East Mifflin Street, he is tired of all this fighting between the Redevelopment Authority and the Housing Authority. He calls everybody into his office, and he cracks heads, and he gets them to agree to something of a compromise, 60 units on the Triangle itself, 40 units for low-income elderly. That would become the Gay Braxton apartments, 60 units elsewhere. Henry Reynolds really was by far the most successful mayor of the 1960s, and he did things like he brought the agency heads in and cracked heads and got a deal where they compromised and moved on. By this time, though, the public press was evidencing some disapproval of Roger Rupnow, the State Journal, calling his representations subtle evasions which either lack wisdom or lack honesty in basic planning. The MHA is so desperate to provide housing for people losing their homes in the Triangle, they readjust their policies for the public housing at Truax and actually kick military personnel out of the public housing at Truax in order to provide housing for the people of the Triangle. By readjusting the amount of income that a household could have and still live at the Truax public housing, they effectively decided, as the director said, to take care of the Madison people before considering military personnel. I'm sure this did not endear us to people in Washington to have Madison throw actual military personnel out of their public housing. At the same time that this is going on, the city and the university are considering a joint urban renewal project, which is approved in May of 1961. Here we see the area that would become the Southeast Dorm expansion area and the area to the north, the Murray Mall area. This is one of those things that nobody realized at the time, but in 3 years would become such an overwhelming issue. This agreement would almost cause the end of urban renewal and the abolition, the absolute abolition by referendum of the Redevelopment Authority. This is one of those things that nobody realized at the time, but in 3 years would become the dominant issue in Madison. Once they agree on the public housing aspect for the Triangle, Chester Medzinski drops his opposition, the project is approved, and even though MG&E disapproved, they did bury the utilities, which again is one of the major improvements of that property. Shortly thereafter, the Redevelopment Authority, again with Babe Rohr as a member who really doesn't have much interest in relocating non-whites, certainly to his ward, takes over the relocation job. And here we see a letter from the husband of Demetra Shivers, the great jazz singer and sister of Odell Taliaferro, complaining to the Redevelopment Authority about the way their relocation officers were dealing with the non-whites living in the neighborhood. And then early January, finally, the federal government releases $2.7 million, and the project is ready to really kick into high gear. Now, I've got a couple minutes left, and I want to talk about one of the critical issues, and that, again, is how race and urban renewal meet in 1960. Here we see the Brittingham, the three properties that were still there in June 1960, the Shack, Zach Trotter's Tuxedo Cafe, and the Spot Tavern. Here we see a close-up of them, the bottom of West Washington Avenue. Now, Zach Trotter had come up from Madison, from Georgia in 1913, operated a billiards hall for a while, and in the 22 years he had owned the Tuxedo Cafe at 763 West Washington Avenue, there had never been any complaints about his character or his conduct. No problems at his bar, but this is land that the Redevelopment Authority wanted for the Brittingham Urban Renewal Area. He finds a place at 1044 South Park Street, formerly Plannert's Flower Shop. It's already zoned for a tavern. Walter Plannert gets a number of vulgar racist calls when it becomes known that he wants to sell to Zach Trotter, but Walter Plannert is a man of honor. He goes through with the sale, conditioned on Zach Trotter being able to move his tavern to 1044 Park Street. But that's in Babe Rohr's district, and Babe Rohr does not want a black man to have a tavern in his district, and the transfer of the license is voted down. Naturally, some people say there is racial prejudice, and the Mayor's Commission on Human Rights does a study and concludes racial prejudice was a motivating factor among a substantial minority of people who signed a petition against the transfer of the liquor license. Racial prejudice intensified the effort that went into it. Trotter even admits that he helped spur this on. Mayor Ivan Nesigan is very concerned. He thinks that this could cause urban renewal to collapse. If people believe there's prejudice involved and bars are not able to relocate, this could kill urban renewal, but the Redevelopment Authority doesn't care. It condemns Trotter's property. It issues him a check for $23,500, which he does not cash, and starts charging him $200 a month in rent, which he does not pay. He finds the Redevelopment Authority proposes a site on Main and Proudfit. That is shot down. The Redevelopment Authority decides to evict Zach Trotter, saying if he doesn't pay the rent, he'll be evicted. Now, remember, this is property that they took from him and now are charging rent, even though the city, another agency of the city government, prevented him from relocating. Maurice Pash charges racism. He finds a site on Beld Street, tries to get that rezoned, but the mayor says that he'll veto the rezoning, and that is rejected. So that's two, maybe three potential areas that Zach Trotter has tried to move to and been denied. So meanwhile, the Redevelopment Authority is charging him rent while the city is not letting him relocate. He wins one court case. Another judge decides to seek immediate eviction. He's ordered evicted if he doesn't start paying rent. The Unitarians, so far the NAACP has tried to get Babe Rohr off the Redevelopment Authority. The Unitarians chime in too. Trotter finds a third site, 1616 Beld Street. Finally, Babe Rohr says he'll take a dive. He will not oppose the transfer to the Beld Street site, and the council votes that approval. There's tremendous uproar because it sort of slips through on a parliamentary procedure that people in the room aren't quite ready for, and it's an explosive night at the city council. People are hollering, they're screaming, they're calling the city council crooks. There is a great deal of unease, to put it mildly. He's still facing eviction. He asks for delay. He doesn't get it. But finally, the day before he's to be removed, the MRA agrees to let him stay if he will pay rent. Finally, in September, he gets a building permit. In February, the building is torn down. In July of 1962, the Trotters opened their new Tuxedo Cafe at 1616 Beld Street, which in more recent years would become known as Mr. P's Place, the place where Gene Parks would hold court effervescently. Well, that's all the time we've got for today to discuss some of the history of urban renewal and civil rights in Madison. We hope you enjoyed it and perhaps learned something about the justification and the racism that was involved in urban renewal and civil rights a couple of generations ago. On behalf of everyone here at Access City Hall and Madison City Channel, I'm Stu Levitan. Thanks for watching. We hope to see you again next time.